Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed can get you started with their online pre-registry online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Well, today it's the Italy Nobody Knows with one of my favorite culinary explorers. He's Fred Plotkin. His new book is La Terra Fortunata, or The Fortunate Land. It's the first book we have about a region not even the Italians visit. The region's called Friuli Venezia Giulia, and it's only 20 minutes out of Venice. Beer expert Steve Beaumont introduces us to the eccentric Lambic beer from Belgium. This can age 17 years. Film critic Rex Reed reminisces about eating with Tennessee Williams. And then, as we do every week in the second half of the show, we are opening the lines for your calls. And that number is 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are ready to get things rolling. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, I understand we finally got you over the big puddle. You went to France, right?
Strange as it sounds, yes. Jane and I, who have traveled around the United States for the last 30 years, finally went to France and actually ate something.
Well, what did you discover? I mean, France through your eyes. Tell me.
Well, we didn't hit the four-star places. I forget, are they four-star or three-star?
Three-star,
okay. Well, we didn't hit the three-star places. What we did was, even though we were dragged kicking and screaming over to France because we were a little nervous about going, we just thought, what can we possibly do here that would be a Jane and Michael Stern-like activity? We realized that there were truck stops in France, so we hung around the truck stops, and we ate where the French truckers, or routiers, I guess, as they call themselves, ate. So it was almost like being at home, but in France.
Well, not quite like being at home, because we did not get meatloaf and mashed potatoes.
So instead you got what? Snails and frog legs?
No, actually, what we got, and it seemed to us to be a specialty of many truck stops there, is couscous, which was fabulous. I mean, obviously, you know, the North African influence is spread throughout these truck stops. We had just some fabulous couscous royale at the Relais de Six Boules along A6 east of Paris. I mean, it was really a spectacular meal, the kind of thing that we would spend maybe 3 days trying to prepare and never do as well as they did at this truck stop for the truckers who sat down at the counter.
Well, I have to admit, Lynn, it really was better. Well, can I really go on record as saying it was better than chicken fried steak?
No, you can't.
No, okay. But it was pretty darn good. And I was happy to see, though, that as elegant as the food in a French truck stop is, that the decor and what they sell to buy in their little gift shop is every bit as tacky as it is in an American truck stop. They had the world's most hideous lamps with sort of like fake deer glued on the bottom of them and pebbles, and when you turned on the lampshade, it was sort of like you could pretend you were walking into the forest. So it was high degrees of kitsch along with high degrees of excellent food.
Okay, enough with the lamps. I want to know about the couscous.
The couscous royale. I mean, it was really a royal presentation. Don't forget, this is a truck stop, and I don't remember the price in francs, but it was less than $10 for a wonderful meal. You get a big, broad soup plate spread with the kind of steamy couscous grain, and then you get a big pot full of root vegetables, chickpeas, hunks of lamb, chicken, and that spicy sausage. I think it's called Maguez, Maguez.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you help yourself, you pile it onto the couscous and eat yourself silly. And then, of course, for dessert, instead of apple pie, we said, all right, we'll have the plat de fromage. And we got this big tray of, like, incredible cheeses for dessert, which, you know, for us in a truck stop was rather unusual.
I just want to comment here that Michael appears to be speaking flawless French. But he, and compared to me, he speaks flawless French since I speak no French. But at this truck stop, he did screw up by saying at the end of the meal.
What I said, I thought I knew French. I said, nous sommes finis. which I thought meant we are finished. But what it means, I guess, is we are done for. what I should have said is nous avons fini. But in fact, the waitress was kind enough to explain to me, no, you're not dead. Vous n'êtes pas mort, monsieur.
You must have given them great laughs.
I think so.
Well,
I'm afraid so.
We sat in the wrong section, which we should have known from American truck stops, that in a truck stop, there's the truckers only section, and then there's the everybody else section. And we sat right down amongst the truckers who were drinking wine, which seems extremely weird thing to do in a truck stop, as opposed to mugs of black coffee. And the waitress came over and asked us if we were truck drivers in French. And Michael said, no, we were not. So they seated us in the polite part of the room, which had pink tablecloths instead of white linen ones, which the truckers got.
And in fact, the host would not let us order anything off the menu other than couscous royale. He was so proud of it.
Really?
We looked, there was a big, broad menu with many different kinds of things, including a steak of a cheval, which I was not that interested in eating.
Yeah, but it's a very big, that means horse meat, and it's
yes,
really
it
popular.
I know it is.
Well, we have two chevals at home.
I couldn't do it with my poor cheval.
It'd be like eating dog meat.
I was tempted, but he said, no, you must have couscous royale. And he was right. It really was the thing to eat.
So you think road food in France really isn't too bad?
I think France is ripe for road food eating, and we just sampled the very tippy top of it. There's much more to eat.
How do you say road food in French?
You're talking to someone who has murdered that language now for 20 years. I'm not going there. Well, I'm very glad to see that, you know, you're going to give France a chance. Thanks,
Cuisine
guys.
Cuisine de route. I don't know. What do I know?
Goodbye, guys.
Au revoir, Lynn.
And now we really are done for. Goodbye.
À mon dernier repas, je veux voir mes frères et mes chiens et mes chats et le bord de la mer. À mon dernier repas, je veux voir mes voisins et puis quelques Chinois en guise de cousins.
The Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. You can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Steve Beaumont is a beer expert who's racked up a lot of frequent flyer miles. He goes anywhere there's a decent beer to be found. He reports on his finds on his website, in his books like The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide, and here on The Splendid Table. Steve, welcome back.
Good to talk to you again, Lynn.
Steve, what's lighting your fire these days?
Well, you know, I'm down to my last bottle, which is tragic, but it's a style of Belgian beer called Lambic. Most North Americans will actually know it as Lambic, because that's the way it's spelled, L-A-M-B-I-C, but the Belgians tend to pronounce it Lambic. And this is, I think, the most eccentric style of commercially brewed beer in the world today.
All right, I'll bite. What do you mean by eccentric?
Well, you know, every beer in the world is brewed with very specific yeast cultures. Brewers are among all the things that they do in the brew house, they're most careful with their yeast because they don't want their yeast to change. They don't want their beer to get infected. They want to be very careful with this one little strain of yeast that ferments their beer. Lambic brewers are completely different. What they do is when they get the beer ready for fermentation, they open up all the windows and they open up these slats in the ceiling and they let wind airborne bacteria and yeasts come in and start fermentation that way. And that is the beginning of Lambic.
What does it taste like?
Well, you know, Lambic assumes many forms. What I just described to you is the beginnings of Lambic, that wild, spontaneous fermentation. After that, the beer is transferred into wooden barrels, and it's aged in these barrels. And after about 6 months to a year, it's known as young Lambic. And this is what you can find in the cafes in the Peyotenland, these wonderful, homey, farm-type cafes with outhouses out back and farm animals and all this kind of stuff. And you can get draft young Lambic, which is almost still. There's almost no carbonation to it at all.
Uh-huh.
It has a very pronounced dryness and some tartness. That's step one. Step two is you take some of these lambics between 1 and 3 years old, and then you blend them together. You put them into a bottle, and you re-ferment in the bottle like you would in a champagne. Then it becomes what's known as gueuze. And just for pronunciation's sake, that's G-U-E-U-Z-E. And gueuze is very aggressively tart in a lot of cases. It's the most wine-like beer I think you can find anywhere in the world. It really has extraordinary complexity to it.
It's 3 years old?
The beers, the component beers are between 1 and 3 years old.
Hey, can you age these beers? I mean, could I lay down these beers and age them further?
Absolutely. The oldest lambic I've ever had was a 17-year-old gueuze. And it amazingly, it still had a lot of its original character, but all those flavors had further matured into even greater complexity. It was a spectacular beer.
Is there one here that we should try?
I recommend Cantillon lambics very, very strongly. I would also suggest the Lindemans Brewery, which is best known for their fruit lambics. And the way Lindemans makes their fruit lambics is they blend 25% fruit juice with 75% young lambic. So you end up with a beer that's pretty sweet and very pronounced fruitiness. This is not a traditional lambic, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But they do make one traditional beer. It's a Cuvée René, and it's a gueuze, a very, very high quality. Really nice beer. Also, when a new arrival, or at least what should be very shortly a new arrival, is Drijfonteinen, which is a brewery in Biersel, just outside of Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
They do some wonderfully dry and almost overly serious. I mean, they're very, very Spartan lambics. And they're coming to the U.S. Very shortly, if not already.
So these are all Belgian beers. These are all Belgian imports.
All brewed in the area just around Brussels, although some breweries in North America have experimented with lambic cultures. So they take this specially cultured strain of wild yeast and various organisms, and they try to inoculate their special wheat beers with it. Not quite the same thing, but certainly in the same spirit.
So what do you like to pair the lambic with?
I find that lambic works really well as an aperitif beer. I like it before dinner as a welcoming beer at parties because it's so dry. It's got that lovely, firm acidity to it that it really gets the appetite going.
Well, Steve, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Beer expert Steve Beaumont is author of The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide. You can find his lambic suggestions on our website. That's splendidtable.org. Coming up, Italy's undiscovered culinary gem, Eating Out with Tennessee Williams, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Se me la cu- that with our endless love affair with Italy, there actually is an undiscovered region, and not even the Italians go there. Now, the region is called Friuli Venezia Giulia, and I, like most people, have made the mistake of calling it simply Friuli. Now, this is the only region in Italy that has both exceptional wines and exceptional food. Our guest, Italian food authority Fred Plotkin, has written America's first book on the region. It's called La Terra Fortunata, or The Fortunate Land. Fred, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Okay, Fred, we need a geography lesson. Where is this place?
Drive out of Venice and turn right, and you are in Friuli Venezia Giulia. It's 20 minutes northeast of Venice.
20 minutes?
That's it.
Okay, but now why doesn't anybody go there?
Because Italians don't know it. So when they tell you about the glories of their country, they don't think to mention Friuli Venezia Giulia, even though it's the only region that has terrain going from seashore through gorgeous wine country, hill towns to high Alps in a tiny place. They don't know it. Their mental geography of Italy ends at Venice. They think of it as this blend of Slavic, Germanic, Italic, and they don't think of Trieste, the capital of the region, as theirs, though it absolutely is. Also, the wines that they know from that region, the white wines specifically, to them taste exotic, foreign, and different. They're not typical Italian white wines in style, and therefore it's a foreign place, although we must confess that since Roman times, this has been a place that has been under Italian influence.
Well, tell me about the food.
The food is distinct because this, as I said, is the crucible of Europe, where the Slavic, Germanic, and Latin cultures all converge. You have these microclimates that have splendid seafood, incredible grains, polenta, barley, wheat, rice, all going into the first courses. You have grapes, you have amazing fruit of all qualities, and no region uses more fruit in its cookery than does Friuli Venezia Giulia. You have the high Alps, you have pastures, you have herbs growing in the ground, you have amazing dairy products, great cheeses that are used in cooking as well as eating, and because of the port of Trieste, you have more spices in this cuisine than any other Italian region. And the best coffee by far, because Trieste was and is the great coffee port of Europe.
Well, that's right, yeah, because it's the seat of a lot of coffee empires, or at least one that I can
think of. And therefore, if you have coffee, you put cake with it, so the best baking in Italy as well.
So you've got everything. You mention in the book that it is an extraordinarily fragrant cuisine.
The pleasure they've discovered of food comes not just in the mouth, but in the nose. And therefore, spices, the fragrances of wines, and there the wines are vinified to be very present in the nose, as they say. All of these fragrances go together. People understand their land very well. They preserve it. They're stewards of the land. And all of this fragrance coming from the land in the form of fruit, vegetables, and herbs goes into the food and is not cooked down. They prize the smells in the food even before they open their mouths to eat it.
It's amazing because this is a place where you find mint and herbs and spices that you just don't associate as being typically Italian.
Saffron, for example, which we think of saffron in Milan's risotto and is coming from Abruzzo. Saffron also grows in southern Austria, and it's a much more refined type, refined in the good sense. And that is the saffron that's used in Friuli Venezia Giulia. And saffron is combined with white asparagus and shrimp and eggs in certain dishes with a glass of Sauvignon Blanc. It's heaven.
Well, it sounds
wonderful. It all goes together perfectly.
Okay, let's talk wines, because these are some of the great undiscovered bargains. Tell me about the wines of the region.
Again, a difference. In most of Italy, you have vino rosso and vino bianco, the local white and red wines. But in Friuli Venezia Giulia only, they understand about food and wine pairings, and they will say that a grape variety, let's say Ribolla Gialla, goes perfectly with scallops. And Sauvignon Blanc goes perfectly with white asparagus and with saffron and shrimp. And Tokaj goes perfectly with prosciutto di San Daniele, which is from the region, and the equal of the ham from Parma. They understand all of these pairings and will construct a meal in such a way that they will have a glass of one, a glass of another, to go with each dish. And therefore, Friuli Venezia Giulia has more grape varieties than any other Italian region. Many native, some of them brought in from elsewhere, but they are grown with great care and the idea that every glass goes with a different dish.
Give me an idea of what to look for.
Well, Tokaj is the most famous of all the wines. It is not the sweet Hungarian Tokaj, spelled with a K. It is T-O-C-A-I, also called Bianco Friulano. And this is sort of a nutty, peachy wine, very dry, that is a white wine. If you order a white in Friuli, not in Venezia Giulia, but in Friuli, you will be given a glass of Tokaj immediately. I love it. It's the one that they love most. My favorite among the whites is Ribolla Gialla, which is a native white grape that tastes like white cream. And when you combine it with seafood, it has fruit, but it's not sweet. It has this incredible mouthfeel, as the wine lovers say, that expands and warms the mouth, even though you drink it cold. And it goes so beautifully with just about all the delicate foods in the region. And it's the great undiscovered white wine of Friuli Venezia Giulia. The third would be Sauvignon Blanc, not like the insipid stuff that comes from California, from France. The only one that rivals it comes from New Zealand, where they do beautiful Sauvignon Blanc. But in Friuli Venezia Giulia, they understand the drama, the power of this wine. It's a big white wine, full of fragrance, full of flavor, that really can stand up to any food.
What do they do reds?
They do fantastic reds. Merlot was there long before it became chic. Merlot has been there since the 1880s. And they think of Merlot as their most popular red wine. My favorite Italian red wine is a native grape from Friuli. It's called Pignolo. There are only five producers, and it's available in North America. It's a little hard to find. It's expensive only because they're so small production, but it's an exquisite wine. It's big without being heavy. It's fragrant, it's fruity, but it's not sweet. It goes beautifully with most meats, with cheeses. It's my desert island red wine.
Which you will take with you if they ever expel you out of Friuli.
God forbid.
Julia. Fred, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Fred Plotkin is author of La Terra Fortunata, The Splendid Food and Wine of Friuli Venezia Giulia. Well, Fred gave us a recipe that showcases the region's classic foods. It's perfect for right now. It's polenta with five flavors. And you can find it on our website, splendidtable.org. There's a list in the back of my mind of people I would have loved to have known by sort of being the fly on the wall in their lives. Well, near the top of that list is the playwright Tennessee Williams. I cut my theatrical teeth on Glass Menagerie and Sunley last summer. I mean, think about it. A little cannibalism, a little insanity, a little murder. I mean, this was my kind of guy. Well, now it turns out that Tennessee Williams was a good eater, too. His friend Rex Reed, the film critic for the New York Observer, reminisces about eating with Tennessee Williams.
In New Orleans, which was quite naturally by way of its own decadence, the favorite city of Tennessee Williams, I once asked his personal waiter at Brennan's to describe his favorite meal. The answer was humorous and quick. Anything I poured. The excesses of America's most prolific, celebrated, and famously tortured playwright have been well documented, but also food was high on his list of passions. The fever he could work up over a crawfish etouffee was equal to Blanche DuBois's dependence on the kindness of strangers. Dining well was an acquired taste he negotiated with no help from home. He once described his mother Edwina, a faded steel magnolia immortalized as the cloying Amanda Wingfield in the Glass Menagerie, as, quote, an old trout terminally allergic to the kitchen with the uncanny ability to make tinned soup taste like dishwater detergent, unquote. He learned at an early age to eat out, and during the years I knew him, his two favorite words were room service. Still, he was an expert chef. If you could just keep him away from the cooking sherry long enough to reduce a sauce or fillet a flounder. The first time I interviewed Tennessee in the haunts of his halcyon days in the old New Orleans French Quarter, he had just recovered from a year of guest appearances in selected rehab clinics. He told me he knew he was in trouble the night he ordered a steak and a chocolate sundae, mistook the chocolate sauce for gravy, and poured it all over the steak. Now, the meal I had with him that night at Antoine's seemed dedicated to his favorite dishes. Anything fattening illegal or on fire, he yelped in a voice like a lazy alligator. But the meal began, as always, with a dozen oysters on the half shell, washed down with a rye old-fashioned, a creme de menthe frappe, a vodka stinger, and a whole bottle of Puy Fuissé. I'm not as young as I used to be, he sighed with a hiccup. The next day, at breakfast at Brennan's, he ordered a pitcher of martinis and studied the menu. He said, I'd like to order a Waldorf salad, but my doctor won't allow me to eat nuts. Then there was a pause. He didn't say anything about cannibalism, though, Tennessee laughed. He settled for eggs sardou and grits and griots with red-eye gravy, topped off with a bowl of flaming bananas Foster. In a city where fried okra is considered a green vegetable, he was perfectly at home to indulge his appetites for the kind of food best self-described as a remedy for depression. Despite the culinary adventures experienced during his restless travels, his tastes were relatively simple. No pomegranate nasturtium sorbet for him. His favorite memory was of the summer he and Carson McCullers rented a shack in Nantucket where they survived on Jack Daniels, canned green pea soup with weenies in it, and an innovation called Spuds Carson, mashed potatoes mixed with olives. In Key West, he lived in a small Art Nouveau candy box on Duval Street with a Boston Terrier bitch named Gigi, who looked like a canine Colette, an orange tabby cat named Gentleman Caller, and a ferocious iguana chained to the front porch to scare off marauders named Mr. Ava Gardner. It was here on hot mornings where he combed the waterfront for a rare catch of pompano and found the shrimp and crabs that made their way into one of the elaborate gumbos he prepared for an illustrious guest list ranging from defrocked bishops to Anna Magnani. His favorite cookbooks were compiled by junior chamber of commerces in every southern town from Baton Rouge to Boca, and a treasured dog-eared thing called white trash cooking. And it was here that he once prepared for me a memorable dinner of smothered roast beef and a Girl Scout recipe for lemon icebox pie with a vanilla wafer crust. When a new play tanked on Broadway, or after some critic published a punishing premature obituary, Tennessee would sigh, "Baby, I soon be forced through penury to resort to using caviar helper." I think his happy hedonism, his zest for food and life, and his wicked sense of humor saw him through every crisis. He told Gore Vidal once that he slept through the 60s. But he didn't miss a meal.
Rex Reed is film critic for the New York Observer. His piece, Cat on a Hot Tin Stove, appears in the November 2001 issue of Gourmet Magazine.
Yeah, it's all today.
have opened the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Rory on the line. So, Rory, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Great show. Love it.
Ah, woman of good taste. Okay, I'm ready to go for it. What's on your mind?
My question is about the chufa bean. And it goes back to San Diego, my question. I used to live in San Diego, and a popular drink there is called horchata. And it's a rice drink where rice is left overnight with water and then blended, and then some cinnamon is added to it. And it's a very popular, refreshing drink in that area. And I believe it's of Spanish origin. And when I was in Spain, we found horchata, but it was called horchata de chufa. And it was sold all over, even the local Dunkin' Donuts in Barcelona had it. And it was even better than the San Diego horchata. And I was wondering if you know where I can get the chufa bean.
You know, Rory, I really think our listeners lay awake at night coming up with the most, you know, arcane or whatever stuff.
Well, you know, Lynn, I did look on the internet first, and I couldn't find anywhere. I found the history of it, and I found all kinds of information about it, just not where to buy it.
How do you spell chufa?
C-H-U-F-A.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. It's. I think, have you checked Latin websites or like ethnicgrocer.com?
No.
Ah, I would do that.
Okay.
Because they may have it.
I've been to Ask Jeeves, and I've asked Jeeves where I can buy chufa.
Oh, but Jeeves is British. What is Jeeves going to know about a Spanish drink made with chufa?
Well, now I'm asking Lynn.
Yeah. Well, this is, I'll tell you the little bit I do know. Chufa is a tuber.
Okay.
It looks like a bean, but it's a tuber. And the drink horchata in Spain is made with chufa, but it's made the way they do it, I think, in Mexico, where they soak it, and then they mix it with sugar and cinnamon.
Right.
And sort of puree it. So, but as far as buying the chufa, I think places that sell Hispanic ingredients, so things like ethnicgrocer.com, you know the other one, Goya, G-O-Y-A Foods?
Uh-huh.
They may lead you somewhere.
Okay.
Goya is a canner. You know, they have a lot of Spanish/Caribbean products.
Right.
But I think ethnicgrocer.com is a good one to start with. It's the one I now have fixed in my brain. I can't think of any other sites.
Okay, well, I'll start there, and I'll call you back if I can't find it.
Dynamite.
Thank you so much.
There's one other word you should look for.
What's that?
And because it's on a lot of Hispanic products. Look for the word amigo. I know it's weird, but there's a lot of stuff out there, you know, that has the name Amigo on it. It may lead you down the right path.
Okay, I'll try that too then.
Okay. And keep dreaming up questions. I love it.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for our weekly food challenge. Now, here's this week's food question. What food doubled as baby food in medieval Germany and was the cotton candy at medieval fairs? We'll have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour, so you can give us a ring by dialing 800-537-5252. But before we go back to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's food question. Now, the question was, What food doubled as baby food in medieval Germany and was the cotton candy of medieval fairs? It was gingerbread. Now, gingerbread cookies and cakes were sold at fairs, just the way cotton candy is today. Now, the baby food connection. Well, at an organic food conference, I met one of Germany's largest producers of organic baby food. When I asked how they came to make baby food, I found out that they'd been making it since the 1600s, because back then, the family were apothecaries or druggists. And one of the nutrients that they sold was gingerbread. People believed for a very long time that spices had curative powers. So by extension, what the spices flavored were considered medicinal. So this family sold an instant baby food. It was a lot like Pablum is today. It was gingerbread crumbs. You added hot water or warm milk and you had baby food. But gingerbread started long before the 1600s. The winter solstice in December was a baker's field day. Gingerbread sold out every single year. Now, this was the time of year when it was dark and cold and threatening. So you had to eat solstice cake to stay healthy, to be lucky, and of course to ward off the evil spirits. Well, I've got a head start for you on the winter solstice. We're going to ward off evil spirits with my recipe for a really moist, dark, spicy gingerbread that's spiked with black pepper. And you can get the recipe on our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's get back to the phones now. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Now, let's see, we've got Linson on the line. Linson, what is the pressing issue you want to discuss?
Well, my fiance loves Thai cuisine.
Uh-huh.
And curries in particular. The problem is I am violently allergic to cumin.
What a shame.
So it took us a while to figure out exactly what it was when I started having problems with both Mexican and Thai.
Right.
And then we started looking at recipes, and there's cumin's just everywhere. But she was trying to find out if there's such a thing as a cumin-free curry.
Oh, I think there is. I mean, I'm not an expert on Thai cuisine, but in looking, you know, a lot of what Thai food is about when it comes to the curries is curry pastes. And there are several types. I mean, I think there's a red roasted chili curry paste, and then there is a green one, and there is a golden one. And often they have a almost mind-boggling array of spices in them. And because of that, you can often leave out something like cumin and not feel like it's a great loss. You know, it'd be one thing if the recipe called for garlic, chili, and cumin. But in the case of a lot of Thai curries, if you want to make them from scratch, and by the way, it's time-consuming to do, but once you do it, you can freeze them in small quantities. You know, just daub them on a piece of wax paper, stick them in the freezer, and when they're frozen, you stick them in a plastic bag. And then you just pull a lump out and you throw it into the pot. And you can flavor things with it. But the point is, yes, I think you could leave out the cumin and you are not going to lose the authenticity or the great flavor. So check out Nancy McDermott has done a wonderful book on curries, Thai curries. She lived in Thailand for a period of time and she's a very pragmatic cook. Her recipes are built around what's really available in our homes and yet going for authentic flavor. It might be a good place to check out. And, you know, if you go up on the net and look at any of the places that are selling books, even secondhand, look under Nancy McDermott and you'll see she's done a couple of books on Thai food.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
And enjoy the curries. This business about making a curry, just sort of FYI, sometimes it's so easy. A lot of these recipes call for you sautéing a whole collection of spices like garlic and ginger and, well, cumin or not, and coriander and a lot of chili. And then you add something like coconut milk to that mix, okay? And then you add the cut-up meat or poultry or fish and you just cook it. You just simmer it. It is so simple. And usually they are the kinds of dishes that making them ahead makes them taste better. Something to file away for when you want something different and you don't want to spend a lot of time. Anything that doesn't require browning a lot of little pieces of things is going to be easy to do. Okay, 800-537-5252. We will talk. And let's see, who's up? We've got Ray calling. So, Ray, what's on your mind?
Persimmons.
Persimmons.
Yes.
Okay.
I have a recipe that sounds fabulous for warm persimmon pudding, the chocolate ganache, a rum custard. It just sounds great. I've never even touched a persimmon, I don't think.
You haven't laid eyes on a persimmon.
And I can't find any friends who ever have eaten persimmons. They have them at the store, and it says to eat them out of hand like an apple.
Right.
But the recipe says, if you don't have a food mill, you can't get out the seeds, and it's so labor-intensive, you won't want to make it.
Oh, poo.
So, are there two kinds of persimmons, or what?
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't sound like the same fruit to me. One you can eat like an apple, and one has all these seeds. So, I just wondered.
You sure it wasn't pomegranate?
No.
It's persimmons.
Eat, and I love, but no, it says persimmons. It says it's a wild fruit, and it's hard to appreciate it unless you can get the food mill.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, here's the deal. There are two kinds of persimmons.
I wonder. We only have one in our store.
All right. Now, are they sort of the size of a small apple?
And they look like yellow tomatoes.
That's right. And they're rich yellowy orange, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's the cultivated persimmons.
Okay.
Now, the wild persimmon is evidently native to our country. It's small, intensely sweet, almost impossible to find. The cultivated persimmon evidently began in Japan. There's 500 umpteen varieties of it. And the key with it is it must be ripe, which means when you handle it, one expert said it should be softer than a baby's bottom.
Okay.
I'm picturing people running around and patting babies' bottoms to get the basic idea of what we're talking about.
So I can
All right, you can check this.
I can test it right away.
But it should give when you press it gently.
Okay.
And if it isn't ripe, it's really astringent, you know?
Oh.
I mean, it makes you pucker. But and if you buy it hard, you can put it in a bag with an apple or an orange, rather an apple or a banana. Yeah, and they ripen.
Okay.
It takes 5 or 6 days or whatever.
Okay. Do they taste like anything I might have eaten?
They taste like a mixture of pineapple, peach, and deliciousness. They can be so sweet and good. But I must tell you that it is a fruit that I don't think is happy when it's warmed. I think this is true of a lot of fruits. A lot of fruits just lose their flavor and their character when they're warmed. And they're really at their best, you know, unheated. Now, this recipe sounds like it's sensational, and I'd say go ahead and try it. But I'll tell you what I do with a persimmon. I take it, I scoop out, I get rid of, there's a thread down the center of it. Get rid of that thread. If you find any seeds, get rid of the seeds.
Okay.
Peel it or not peel it. But what I do is I like to mash it up and mix it with whipped cream and freeze it partially and then eat it like a slightly melting ice cream. And the other thing is, because they're in season only like late fall into winter, when you get them really ripe, you can freeze them. And the best way to do it is just go to the side opposite the stem end, cut off like just the top tenth of that.
Okay.
Wrap them up in, put them in a plastic bag and freeze them. And the way you would serve them is you take them out of the fridge about 4 hours, take them out of the freezer 4 hours ahead, put them in the fridge, and to serve them, put them in a wine glass and you scoop out with a spoon out of that persimmon. It's like its own little collapsing cup, and it's like eating semi-frozen sweet sorbet.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
And then try your recipe, too.
Okay.
Okay, so stock up.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, now you can go and squeeze baby's bottoms.
Yes. thank you very much.
Pass the word. Thanks for calling. Goodbye. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. This is persimmon season, and I'd say grab them, you know, ripen them up on the counter, and then freeze them, because you'll have them. And they're really great. I mean, they're the easiest no-work dessert. And because they're not very common, everybody kind of sits there and goes, ooh, ooh, ooh. Okay, let's see. Who's next? We've got Deb on the line. Deb, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm wondering if you can help me find black pudding, a place to purchase black pudding.
What kind of black pudding?
Scottish or Irish, either or.
May I ask, do you know what black pudding is?
I do.
Have you had black pudding?
I have.
Why don't you share with the rest of us what black pudding is?
Well, it's sort of a breakfast dish in Scotland and in Ireland, and it's made from oats, seasoning, and blood. There's also a white pudding, which doesn't have the blood.
Right, right. Do you know that this idea, almost every country where they slaughter an animal and have cold weather or cool weather, has some kind of sausage, they may call it pudding, they may call it boudin, made this way, because blood used to really be considered very, very healthy. As far as where to get it, you know what the problem is now? Because most of it came from, most of the blood does come from steers. A lot of it's banned these days.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's going to be really tricky. If it exists in a safe form, one place that comes to mind is an old German sort of butcher shop, but they do a lot of all their own sausages. It's on 86th Street or near 86th Street in New York City, and it's called Schaller Weber. I think it's S-C-H-A-L-E-R and then W-E-B-E-R or E-B-B-E-R. They used to make black pudding.
Great.
But it's so rare anybody wants to eat this. It used to be, you know, in the days when everyone, when it was safe, I can remember offering it to friends and they, you know, well, you know what they do. They make unpleasant sounds and run out of the room.
Right.
It was really not fun at a dinner party. I wish you good fortune.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we've got Jan calling. Hey, Jan, what's up?
Well, it's soup time again here in Ann Arbor, and I want to make my favorite lemongrass soup, and it calls for kefir lime leaves, and I've been hunting and hunting for them, and one of the Asian grocery owners says that she can't get them anymore, and I can't find them in any of the markets, so I wondered if you knew of a source or maybe a substitute for them.
All right, now this is kefir lime from Thailand, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah, and they're, just so everybody understands, it's a really crisp, sort of bright green, shiny leaf. And the smell, how would you describe the smell of kefir lime? That leaf, because it has that limey smell, but there's something more to it.
I really can't figure a substitute.
I'll tell you what you see in recipe books. You often see using lemon and lime zest. And
okay.
every you know, respectable cook tells you also, who's writing these recipes, it's not the same thing. Because to me, you get that scent from the kefir lime, but you also get this almost soapy, flowery aroma. Now, haven't looked lately, but I've seen them frozen in a lot of Asian markets.
Okay.
But there is a website out there. There's two websites I would check out.
Okay.
One is ethnicgrocer.com, and the other one is thaigrocer.com.
Okay.
Talk about being specialized.
Yeah,
and I would check them out because I haven't shopped for them recently, but we have a lot of Asian markets in my area, and I've certainly seen them. I've seen them fresh, and I've seen them frozen.
Really?
Yeah, I check those two sources out, and if you really get into a pinch, combine some lemon zest and lime zest.
All right.
And it's not the same, but kind of close.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, thanks.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. I was cruising the web the other night, and I came across a website called beerismylife.com. Now, there's this fellow named Richard Steven, who works at a brewery in Wisconsin, who has created this website to share his experiences. This is a man who has tasted 3,888 beers, and this is what he says. He's tasted and cataloged these beers since January 1992, and he says, actually, there should be a lot more beers on this list, but I wasn't always capable of writing during some of the tasting sessions. We tracked Richard down in the brewery and got him on the line. Richard, welcome to the Splendid Table.
Thanks, Lynn.
Now, Richard, what drives a man to taste 3,888 beers?
Well, I guess the short answer is because they're there. There is such a rich variety of beers in the world, and not just around the world, but in the United States since the early 80s with the explosion of the microbrew industry, that beer it's become more of a food product.
But, you know, I know a lot of people who like beer, but there aren't many people who have set about doing the task that you've set about doing. What drove you?
Originally, 10 or 15 years ago, I worked for a company in New Jersey, and I spent a lot of time traveling around the country installing computer software. And I had 10 or 12 engineers working with me, and we'd travel to these various cities and do our work, and we'd be stuck in these towns for a week or more. Mm-hmm. So we had to plan out where the restaurants were and where the taverns were. So we started keeping a list that we could email around to each other to say, you know, where's the good food, where's the good beer? And then when I left that job and moved to California and discovered the great variety of microbrews that were available there in 1989 or so, it seemed like more people needed to know about this. So I kind of took that list and pared it down to just the breweries and put that up on the Internet. Beers My Life was actually, as far as I know, the third beer site on the Internet ever.
Uh-huh.
So we've been at this a while.
And now you work for a brewery.
Now I'm a professional brewer now.
Uh-huh. So how do you judge a beer?
It's I'm not going to pretend that it's objective. A lot of it is what am I in the mood for that day. I mean, I try to be as fair as I can. There are 4 points I look at, the appearance, aroma, flavor, and an overall impression.
I see. So what are you tasting this week?
I taste whenever I can get my hands on a new beer. I just had a couple yesterday. Your count, in fact, was a little off. It's 3,899 now. I'm a little behind on my typing.
I understand.
It comes out to about a beer and a half every day for the last 9 years.
Well, Richard, you keep up the good work. You're at the Egan Brewing Company in De Pere, Wisconsin.
That's right.
And thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for calling, Lynn.
You can find Richard's website at beerismylife.com. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with a quote from A.J. Liebling. He said, "She was as beautiful as a tulip of beer with a high white collar." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place you can register for Target's own kitchen essentials. Hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.